The 100 Years' War, to the Guesclin period, the results of the Truce of Bruges, Part 1. During July and August of 1375, the heralds passed through the war zones of western France proclaiming the Truce of Bruges to the sound of the trumpets in the market squares of provincial towns and before the closed gates of countless garrison fortresses. As a result of successive extensions, formal hostilities between England and France were to be suspended for a period of almost exactly 2 years. Conceived in an untidy compromise, the Truce of Bruges was seen in England as a triumph of French diplomatic guile, yet it ended by disappointing even French expectations. The first problem about it became apparent almost immediately. Although the truce extended in theory to Castile, Henry of Trastamara had not been represented at Bruges and never regarded it as binding upon him. The ink was scarcely dry on the document before a fleet of 80 galleys and carracks sailed from the Biscay ports of Castile under the command of the Admiral of Castile to prey on English shipping. On August 10, 1375, they sighted a large English convoy which had put into the Bay of Bourgogneuf to take on cargo of salt on its way back from Gascony. The heavily laden English ships, cornered in a confined space of the bay, were sitting targets for the galleys. 39 of them were captured, including 22 of more than 100 tons burden, whose loss would be felt by requisitioning officers for years to come. In another incident, a few weeks later, two ships bound for England were captured in the Bay of Biscay by armed Castilian merchantmen. On board one of them was Florimond de Lespar, Edward III's former acting seneschal in Bordeaux. He was on his way to England for discussions with the council. He appealed in vain to the truce. They took him back to Castile as a prisoner. The King of Castile was unrepentant. As long as John of Gaunt continued to claim his crown, he would have his own quarrel with England, whatever Charles V chose to do. At the end of the year, he had informed the ambassadors of the King of France and the Duke of Anjou that he regarded himself as still being at war with England. A more persistent threat to the truce came from the continuing operations of those doggone Gascon companies in central and southern France. The terms did not require them to surrender their captured fortresses in French territory, but did restrict their operations. Apart from enforcing arrears of patès under existing agreements, the companies were forbidden to ransom the country around them or engage in acts of violence against the French king's subjects. This was a severe test of their rather ambiguous relationship with the king's counselors at Westminster and Bordeaux. The trouble, as Froissart judiciously observed, was these professional brigands didn't know how to stop fighting. At the beginning of 1376, when the truce had been enforced for 6 months, the French complained that the war was still being fought across the provinces in the southwest area of the Santage, Perigord, Quercy, Limousin, and Auvergne. Politically, the most sensitive of these regions was Perigord, which was close to Bordeaux on the main road and river routes between Gascony and the Central Highlands. The truce was hardly noticed there. The English still securely held the Dordogne Valley below Linde, and further north their cause was sustained by a large Anglo-Gascon garrison at Bretonne on the River Drone and by Raymond de Montant, Lord of Mussidan. Raymond was a formidable guerrilla leader, had been one of the Prince of Wales' closest companions, and remained loyal to his successors long after most men in his position had recalculated their advantages. His partisans were active in the valleys of the Ill and the Vézy throughout the truce. Their main target was the provincial capital, Perigord. Rich by the standards of a poor province, insecure behind its dilapidated walls, and reduced to the misfortunes of past wars to little more than 500 households. As the autumn evenings drew in, the citizens were obliged to mount watches as if in time of war and make bonfires in the ditches beyond the walls to light up the approach of ladder parties on moonless nights. Within a few weeks of the proclamation of the truce in Perigord, Marshal Sancerre had been sent into the region to enforce it. Unfortunately, the forces at his disposal were not nearly adequate to the task, and he was never able to make much impression, except in the immediate vicinity in which he was operating. The French protested bitterly to Sir Thomas Felton in Bordeaux and endeavored to put in the service the creaking machinery of enforcing the truce. The Joint Commission of Conservators and Truce met in late November 1375 in the small village of Caudrot, halfway between Les Rollets and Les Gaumes, which marked the boundary between English and French territory so far as it was possible to speak of one. The lawyers made promises of amendment and damages, and the raids continued. Fresh complaints followed within 3 weeks. The French government was unbending in its assistance that the cost of defense of these against these companies would have to be met on top of the aids and fouages by special contributions from the regions directly affected. The policy applied as much in Perigord as anywhere. In December of 1375, Charles V recalled Saint-Cyr and announced that the constable would be sent southwest with a much larger army in the new year. But when Du Guesclin arrived in February 1376, his first act was to haggle about money. He told the consuls of Perigord that he was in principle willing to concentrate his efforts in their area, but it would depend on what they could offer him. The neighboring province of Saintonge had also asked him to intervene and offered him much more attractive grants. What was it worth? In the event, it took a promise of free supplies for his armies and a yield of 1 franc hearth tax for their wages. Whether the taxpayers of Perigord got their value for money is difficult to question. The constable lay siege to Bretomé at the beginning of March 1376, and the Anglo-Gascon garrison was eventually bought out 6 weeks later. But the long-suffering inhabitants of the regions had to pay the cost of this composition on top of the expenses of his army. Moreover, the constable's operations lit as many new fires as it extinguished old ones. While his men were encamped around Bretomé, he formed raiding parties to descend on the valley of the Dordogne, in much the same way as Raymond de Montar had done in the valley of the Ill. Du Guesclin denied he was breaking the truce, and he may well have been right, the distinction between offense and reprisal almost impossible to draw. The result, however, was to spread the fighting into Bergerois and southern Perigord, where persistent dogfights would break out between the English and the French for several months to come. Without troops or money, Edward III's representatives in Bordeaux were powerless to intervene. Quote, "I think the constable will do more evil before he withdraws," the mayor of Bordeaux resignedly wrote to the Archbishop of Sudbury, as he was if he was speaking to another country. So we've got some of these little issues that, of course, continue periodically, and we'll have to see how they work themselves out. Now, the sources for this, The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylance, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.